I call this meeting to order. Please stand for the flag salute.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
May we have the roll call?
Councilmember Deedy.
She has been excused.
Councilmember Oglesby.
Here.
Councilmember Edelman.
Here.
Councilmember Stout.
Here.
Councilmember Wisnowski.
Here.
So I'm going to go ahead and we're going to discuss the city's TDR program. We're going to let City Attorney David Linehan go ahead. David.
Thank you, Mayor. So we are here to talk about the TDR program. In your materials that you would have received for this work study, there is a proposed resolution, and then there are a number of exhibits to that, and then I've also included some background materials. I don't want to start with a resolution because I think that's starting in the wrong place. I thought it would be a good idea, particularly for some of our newer council members, if we start at a high level, talk about kind of the basics of what a TDR program is designed to do, talk about the history of City of Black Diamond's TDR program and how it's been designed, and then kind of drop down lower to talk about implementation and the specific proposal that's in front of you and we'll be coming back to you at a future council meeting. So, and I'll probably be talking a lot. Feel free to just interrupt me because I'll be happy to answer as many questions as I can as we go along rather than saving it up and having you forget what you were going to ask me. So, high level, TDR program. What is a TDR? What does that mean? Black Diamond Municipal Code, Chapter 19.24, is the location where Black Diamond's TDR program is codified. How did it come about? Well, TDRs stands for Transferable Development Rights, and the idea behind a transferable development right is that some cities want to be able to preserve their natural areas, their wildlife habitat, their lakes, streams, sensitive areas, open space, preserve those types of important environmental resources.
Or cultural
resources as well. Yeah, it's not limited to simply, you know, green space. It can be other things as well. To preserve those for future generations, and in exchange for, for protecting areas that might otherwise be developed, taking those development rights and moving them to another part of the city where the city wants to encourage growth and development. So if there's a part of town that's been zoned for higher density, higher growth, more infrastructure is going to go in there, then that development could be encouraged by allowing the people in those, they're called receiving areas, to receive development rights from the sending areas. So you've got TDR sending areas, you've got TDR receiving areas. And if you think about that, it's just that the landowners in the sending areas can send, usually through a monetary transaction, can send their development rights off of their property and send it to a receiving area so that the people in that area can develop to a higher density than would otherwise be allowed under the code. So to give you just one kind of concrete example to think about in your mind, if somebody who's in a designated sending area has a one-acre parcel, we'll just use 1 acre because the math is easy, under the code, the standard low-density residential zoning in the city, you could develop 4 dwelling units on that 1 acre. Well, those 4 dwelling units could be considered 4 development rights. So the owner of that sending area parcel could send 1 or 2 or 3 or all 4 of those development rights. You have to keep 1, 2, or 3 development rights off of that sending parcel to a receiving parcel so that if the receiving area was zoned R4, instead of being able to build 4, now they can build 7 because they've just acquired 3. So it creates higher density development or the potential for higher density development in one part of town and preserving low density and open space in another part of town. So that's kind of the general concept. So you've got transferable development rights, you've got sending areas and receiving areas. All of that is...
Specific areas that are designated, this is a sitting area.
Yes.
This block.
Correct.
And then...
You have a map.
You have a map, and the way that those...
The goal is not to get in there yet.
Well, no, but we're... Yes, exactly right. So when the Black Diamond TDR program was adopted, at the same time, there was a map that was approved by the council at that time, and that the map is color-coded, and it shows you the areas that are designated sending areas and the areas that are designated receiving areas. I believe the pink areas on the map are the receiving areas, and there's various colors of sending areas. And if you'll see, the sending areas kind of roughly correspond to existing streams and lakes and wilderness areas and sort of nearby properties as well. This was way before my time, so I'm not sure exactly how the process went about designating what was a sending area. But I will. What I can say is that the receiving areas were not exclusively, but largely the result of go way back to the 1990s when there was some rural area in King County that the city wanted to bring into the city limits, take it out of rural and bring it into urban city limit development potential. In order for that annexation to happen, there were some negotiations and stuff with King County. And the result of those negotiations, or one of the results, was one of the background materials that I left in your packet, which is the Black Diamond Urban Growth Area Agreement. We call it the BDUGA, because that's much more fun to say than Black Diamond Urban Growth Area Agreement. So the BDUGA, and I didn't include the entire thing because it's a complicated document. I included some of the key portions that I thought might be relevant to discussion today. It defines the idea of a transfer of development rights program. At the time, Black Diamond didn't have a TDR program. The BDUGA dates to, I think, 1996 or something like that. But the idea was that in order for this annexation to bring land into the city limits, in order for that to occur, there was kind of a give and take. The trade-off was going to be, okay, there's going to be commitments, legal binding commitments, to have preserved open space within the city limits. And so because they knew that the owners of that annexation area wanted to develop, bring in some urban density there, the idea was, okay, there's going to be some offset, there's going to be some preserved open spaces within the city, and this BDUGA kind of lays out the way that could be achieved. And one of the ways it was to be achieved was that any development that was going to occur in those annexation areas would be kept to a low density unless they were able to acquire development rights, use TDRs to transfer development potential out of in-city properties and into this new annexation area. Of course, the annexation area largely corresponds, at least parts of the annexation area largely correspond to Ten Trails and Lawson Hills. So that's kind of the genesis of where this TDR program came from, was the idea that in order to allow urban development, urban density development in these annexation areas, there would be preserved natural space or cultural space or other types of things that fit the definitions of the TDR program within the city limits. Within the BDUGA materials that I included here, you know, if you have those and you want to just kind of look at them, you can kind of see some of the specifics. I'll let you turn in your hymnals to page 10 to get out. And so page 10 of that BDUGA attachment is a section 6 called Urban Development in the Annexed Lands. And section 6.3 of that talks about residential density. And if you look at like the last sentence of section 6.3, that first paragraph, it says the base residential density shall be 2 dwelling units per acre. So that's the base development potential of this annexation area. Additional residential zoned residential density shall be achieved through participation in the city's TDR program. So the idea was, if you're going to go more dense than the 2 you're allowed, you're going to have to buy TDRs in order to achieve that. fast forward a few years, and that's when the city actually adopts the TDR program, develops the TDR map, assigns sending areas within the city, and assigns receiving areas, with this annexation area being one of the primary receiving areas.
Were those areas negotiated with homeowners? Did homeowners come out and say, I want to be a part of that?
There was a big process in going out and this map, you know, the idea that this showed potential sending areas then went out, letters went out to property owners.
Okay.
About, well, the city is doing this TDR program. And it was, first of all, the process was a preliminary letter that said, we think you have this much, and, you know, and then they had a big, they did have a workshop. And then they allowed, between the preliminary and the final notice to the property owner and the sending site, they allowed for some discussion and even, you know, maybe not even, more of an argument about what this person thought they should get. Mm-hmm. There were some of those in the file. And then once established, that final number of estimated TDRs went out in a form letter to that landowner.
So on the map here, it talks about TDR sending areas. There's primary and secondary, and then the 50% open space primary and secondary. Can you explain that?
Barb, do you want to take a crack at that one?
No. Study science and the boxes on what this really means, and I honestly don't understand it.
I can give you some general principles. I don't know exactly how they were applied. So the Baduga, for example, talks about primary and secondary open space. So those were terms that were understood at the time to mean something. How those were actually applied to identify these as the primary and secondary open spaces, I have no idea. Yeah, it's just a historical fact. The map was adopted by ordinance, so, you know, by local law, these are the sending and receiving areas.
Okay. I have a question about the process also. Just because you have an acre of space, doesn't mean that you could necessarily put for, you know, places on
correct
every single solitary 1 acre
right
plot in the city.
Correct.
So I guess my question is, was it assumed that we would give, and by we I don't mean me, that 4 credits, so to speak, mm-hmm. would be given to every single solitary acre? I mean, we're just using your number.
Right, exactly. That was all it's intended to be.
Was there like a fabulous survey where everybody went out and measured and said, oh yes, this is really developable right here, or, you know, halfway over the cliff, no, we're not developing that, so that won't count as a...
So that answer to your question, again, I can't speak necessarily factually to what exactly was done, but there's a code provision that speaks to that. And so 1924.030 talks about the calculation of development rights. And it says, in calculating available development rights, the area of the parcel that is within the TDR sending area shall be used. A minimum of one-fourth acre of the parcel must be contained within the area to be protected for transferable development right eligibility. No fractional development rights shall be created. And I won't read you the whole thing, but it's sort of that default premise is 4 per acre. So now, whether somebody went out and identified every part of land in that, I don't think that happened. But that's the way the map was put together.
There's some kind of calculation that happened because there's a sign up here on the highway, property is 43 TDRs.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Advertising?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, the property is for sale, and
there's the base density calculation, right, which is in the ordinance, mm-hmm. and through the mechanism. So if you take a commercial piece of property, do what it's done, the base, and then multiply it by the treasured status, so that sign would be what it has ultimately, the treasured status plus the multiplier for commercial over the base TDR program. Mm-hmm. So they're stacking everything in their favor. When
so,
they write the 43.
Yeah, so Andy just ramped up the complexity of the program. But so there's ideas. Yes, so there's bonus credits, bonus development right credits that you get if your property is deemed by the city to be a treasured place, and there's a definition in the code for what meets a treasured place definition. It's sort of like, we think this is really important, and so if you're going to conserve this against future development, you get extra rights that you can sell. It's kind of the most straightforward way of explaining that concept. And yeah, he picked up on the nuance I haven't explained yet, but yes, commercial is different from residential. The calculations are different for commercial sending areas versus residential sending areas. So, so where were we? So that's the general concept of the TDR program. I thought maybe it would be helpful to talk about the specifics of Black Diamond's TDR code, again, sort of in a general way, and so that if you have questions about how the process is supposed to work and how it's implemented, now, you know, this would be a good time to explore those. So maybe if you want to look in your packet for the section that's Black Diamond Municipal Code 19.24. So on the first page, you've got, you know, your table of contents, your index there, the various code provisions. There's definitions for all these terms that we've been talking about. We've covered some of them. When the TDR program, Barb sort of mentioned this briefly a minute ago, when the TDR program was adopted, the city sent out preliminary letters and then later, after some fact-finding and discussion, final letters to the property owners to say the city has determined you have X number of development rights on your property.
Estimated.
Yes. Yes, and they're not necessarily set in stone because things change over time. So if between the time they receive their final letter of notice and the time when they come in to get what's called a development rights certificate, if they've developed their property in some way, then obviously they've used up some of their development rights or other things that could happen that could change that determination.
So when did this program get written up?
It was 2009 was when it was adopted. So this was kind of in the lead up to the MPD approvals, because this TDR program had to be in place before the MPDs could be approved. The MPD code, which I don't think I included that. Oh, no, I did, actually, a little bit. So Chapter 1898 of the code, we don't need to look at it now, but one of the components of that is that the code requires an MPD to achieve those urban densities has to use a TDR program. So the TDR program had to be in place before any MPDs could be approved, or else you'd be approving something that couldn't be built. So backing up, the final letters of notification went out and established the sort of baseline assumptions of the what the development rights would be for all the parcels within the sending areas. There's descriptions of the treasured place and, you know, what qualifies for that treasured place bonus credit that you would get. It walks through the process of how the city went about notifying the owners of their TDR eligibility and how they would be calculated. There's a provision there for designating treasured places, how that process works. So if somebody applies to be designated as a treasured place, there's a description of how that determination gets made. I'm going to skip the TDR bank. I'm going to come to that in just a minute. If we go like to section 060, this is how the development rights actually get turned into a final letter of notification to an actual certificate, a development rights certificate that can be bought and sold. So when a property owner wants to or thinks they might want to engage in a transaction, sell some of the development rights, the code requires them to come in and get a development rights certificate from the city that says, okay, this is how many you have. And there's some requirements that the property owner has to go through that are listed in 060 of how they show that, yes, they still have the deed to the property, if they've done anything to the property development-wise between the time they got the letter and the time they're coming in for the development rights certificate, they disclose what's been done so the city knows, oh, yeah, you do still have those, or maybe you don't still have those anymore. You have to show that your that if you don't own the property outright, if there's a lien, if there's a mortgage on your property, that the mortgage holder is willing to let you strip off the development rights from your property, because obviously that can impair the collateral value if that's supporting the mortgage. And so you have to show that the lender is willing to sign off on this process. And there, you know, there's some other requirements. The key one I think we'll talk about more later is the one listed in number D7, 060 section D7. And this is how the city gets protected in this process. D7 says that the owner of the property has to show that they are willing to grant the city a conservation easement in a form approved by the city that restricts development on that parcel going forward in the future. And so it's an acknowledgement that before that development rights certificate can be used later, that property is subject to a conservation easement that's been recorded with King County and highly restricts what can be done on that property. So you can preserve those environmental qualities, the cultural resources, the aesthetics, the open space, you know, whatever the values were that made that a sending place to begin with.
Okay, so I've got a piece of property and I want to get my certificate. I get it and it's in my name.
Yes.
I now sell that property.
Correct.
To someone new.
Mm-hmm.
Does it show up in a title report or, you know, does that happen? And then the next question is, okay, mm-hmm. I now have an acre of property and I want to subdivide it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I've signed all of those pieces of paper. Uh-huh. I don't have a clue, maybe, what some of them even mean.
Right.
I signed them all anyway.
Uh-huh.
When I come into the city to get my permitting to do this,
uh-huh.
how does the city know, because it's now under a new name?
Right. So your questions are interrelated, and they are addressed in the sections of the code that talk about the city's TDR database. So, Barb, a little bit, but it's fine. It's a good time to jump ahead.
Well, I think maybe, though, that conservation easement is going to be key. The development rights certificate gets recorded
mm-hmm.
with the county. So you've got a recorded document with an auditor's file number that's traceable. The conservation easement gets recorded, and again,
mm-hmm.
those are key pieces
mm-hmm.
to us being able to.
So that all does show up like in your title, a title report.
Yeah,
and that. I'm thinking, all right, 10 or 15, 25 years
right.
from now,
it stays with the parcel, not the legal owner.
Okay.
Right. And because you know none of us are going to be here in the positions that we hold today, and so you lose that brain trust.
Right. So there's two things. There's two things that happen. One, the city has a TDR database where they keep track, where the city, Barb's department, is in charge of keeping track of who owns, who is the registered owner, if you will, of each development rights certificate. And every time it changes hands, there's a provision in the code that says they have to come in and give the city notice of the deed of transfer and who was transferred to and how many development rights. So if there were 10 development rights with a DRC and they only sold 6, the city knows, okay, I have to transfer 6 credits to the recipient and the seller keeps 4, this database just gets maintained. So that's how the city keeps track. Correct.
There's only recording if they go through the steps to get the DRC.
Correct.
Right.
Yeah.
So if you don't go through the steps to get the DRC, there is no recording. Nothing will show up on your title report.
Yeah.
But there's nothing to sell until you have
right.
the DRC.
Right. Well, yeah. Because at that point, you've just got your 1 acre of property,
mm-hmm.
and you just are going to sell it. That's
right.
Yeah.
So then, as Barb was saying, too, at the time that the transaction takes place, the time that the buyer acquires the development rights and the seller signs over the DRC, that's when the conservation easement gets recorded. The escrow agent for that transaction has to take care and ensure that it gets that the conservation easement gets recorded with King County. The city gets notice of that when that happens. The parties involved pay all the fees for doing that so that the city's not writing checks for any of this stuff happening. So that's kind of how the process is supposed to play out, is the there's a recording process that protects the parties involved in the transaction and anybody they sell their property to so that they're aware they get notice of this happening. And the city's protected through the administrative process of recording transfers and paying a transfer fee for the city to administer the database.
So it's not really any different than if you were going to sell your property and it had some other kind of a restriction on it, like you already had an easement for
Correct.
Facilities or somebody to drive to their property
exactly.
or whatever. It's just mm-hmm. a similar legal
Correct.
Thing that would be attached to the property
yep. Correct.
Forever.
Forever. It's in yeah. perpetuity. And it's and the city becomes the enforcing agent for that. So if anybody...
Take it back and change your mind and no. say, oh, I want my X number of dollars back and then I'll, you know, put up my condos or whatever.
Correct. The city...
You already did this and maybe somebody did some development
right.
because you already...
Correct. Yeah, it's in perpetuity. It runs, Barb said it runs with the land, so regardless of who the owner is, it's always on the title. And, you know, there are, one of the things we're going to talk about in a little bit is it may be that a property owner who has a sending site doesn't want to strip all the rights off, maybe only half. So that the nature of that transaction, whether they sold half or 40% or 80% or however many, that gets tracked through the city system, when the city can always know when that person comes in later and says, okay, now I want to develop my property, we can say, oh, well, we can see through our database that your property is subject to a DRC and you've sold 80% of your development rights, so you only have the 20% left. And that helps us know what can and can't be built on that property. And they don't, you know, not that anybody would ever try to get away with it, anything, but if the original owner sells and maybe the transaction of the property changes hands a few times down the road, that person might not have a clue unless they look at their title or look at the, you know, look at the title report. So, yeah. So, do you, you know, they need to do their due diligence when they're buying properties with development rights certificates.
Well, now, is that something that the real estate agent or whatever, when you do that, needs to disclose?
I would hope so.
They're required to disclose these on property.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it would be, I would think it would be, you'd have all kinds of legal liability if you were failing to disclose it. Certainly the seller would have to, so. So that's kind of the general overview. I want to now focus on two specific features of the TDR program and how they fit into this resolution and the proposal that's going to come back to you in a future meeting. One of the pieces of the TDR program that I skipped over was the TDR bank, and that's section 1924.055. So the TDR bank was created at the time the code was adopted, and the bank is just sort of a conceptual idea. There's no building that's the bank or anything. It's just a database, basically, that the city can maintain. The bank has really two main features. One is that the city actually owns TDRs in the bank. The city has 1,000 TDRs that it can sell. So a developer who is required to use TDRs can acquire TDRs from the city, but there's a catch. They have to be able to demonstrate that they weren't able to acquire TDRs from others within the city who could sell them TDRs. So if somebody wants to sell and they're stuck, a developer can acquire TDRs through the TDR bank. However...
I knew we entered the twilight.
I was like, are we about to be raptured? What was going on here?
So, the bank is there.
Yeah.
It's set up for the sole purpose of a developer being able to come in and then buy those TDRs.
Well, that's one of two purposes, but yes, that's one of the purposes.
Does the city have the right to say no?
We'll talk about that in a privileged context, okay?
Property owners sell TDRs to the bank?
Yes.
In other words, if I have TDRs on my property and I don't plan on using them and no one is looking around to buy them, I can sell them to the bank.
But there's all sorts of procedures for that, and we'll have to, I'd have to look at that more carefully because I haven't really looked at that carefully yet. But yeah, the bank is there, and one of the functions of the bank is to hold those pre-existing TDRs that the city owns.
How did you come up with the number of pre-existing TDRs?
1,000. It was a random number. Just a good number. But I mean, one of the functions of the bank, I forget what gets you, is ultimately when we sell those TDRs, then the revenue there is the city is then to go out and to try to purchase additional open space.
Yeah.
Because there might be people who would feel more comfortable dealing with the city than maybe with a developer or whatever. Mm-hmm. It was just another option.
Yeah.
Is that required or is that just suggested?
Well, the proceeds that come from those, again, we can talk about that maybe in a privileged context, but the proceeds from that, again, it's part of that whole trade-off in the Baduga that the TDRs are supposed to trade density for open space. And so the idea is if you're going to allow development to occur, that there's going to be offsetting open space elsewhere so the city can have the means to make sure that that happens.
So these TDRs to the city isn't actual property that we currently own.
Correct.
We would take the money as part of that transaction and then go buy property that could become open space.
Correct. Right? Yeah. Okay. Open space, or there's actually a few other things. City, yes.
A public benefit.
Things that are
like
a public benefit.
Forest, you know, that kind of thing.
Exactly.
Yep. So is it in the code that that's what the money can be spent on and nothing else?
Yeah, I can't remember the code section. That's a good question. Where is that, Barb? Do you know?
Code, I know. Where is
Yes.
10 trails
mm-hmm.
to do whatever it is that
we're
going to do.
Mm-hmm.
Does the TDR bank mm-hmm. have enough already, or do they still have to find some from the outside? If,
right.
for example, not a single solitary person
right.
in the city was willing to start with their TDR.
Right. So the chart you're referring to is in the Village Development Agreement tab. And you'll see in that there's a chart. It's table 484. Each phase has a cap on the number of units that can be built before the developer has to go and use TDRs. So when they start getting close to that cap is when they need to start come withdrawing TDRs, either finding someone to buy them from right then and there, or withdrawing TDRs from the bank.
And can they buy property of their own that's not necessarily owned by all properties owned by somebody, right?
Correct.
But they could just go buy property and develop someplace else and leave that.
You mean own both the city and the city property?
Yeah, I don't think so. They could do that. Yeah. They could do that. So each phase has a maximum, and
they just buy the property and take the TDRs. They're from the property they sold to.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
True. They don't have to. They don't have to buy the property though. They can just buy the TDRs from somebody else. If
I guess all of my questions are aimed at, is there enough
right.
space out there mm-hmm. for the developer who has a specific
plan right this very minute to cover what they need to do at some point. I mean, it's going to, they're going to be able to do it no matter what.
So I don't have all the math in my head at the moment. I don't know, Barb or Andy, do you know how many DRCs are available? I know, that's what I'm trying to find out. Do we know the total number of TDRs that are on the program map?
Oh, I should have brought this Excel spreadsheet.
Do we have that spreadsheet?
We have that number, but I didn't bring the spreadsheet. And I don't know.
I mean, I think the TDR bank, that 1,000 units, was designed as a as a backstop, a cushion, if they couldn't find enough to acquire elsewhere, that those would be there, since it is a required element that they use. How the math actually works out, I'm not sure if it's 100, if that covers 100% or not. But we can, I'm sure Barb can find that information and provide.
Yeah, I can see what the estimated total available are out there, because I have a different spreadsheet. But then the other part of this is, how many do they need?
And how many do they already own?
Yeah, right.
And
what's the gap, right?
Right, and then,
or is there a gap?
There is a provision in here if time has changed your property.
Right.
So it's more wet than when this was initially done. There is a mechanism for you to come in and go through to have a wetland analysis done on your property to perfect your TDR numbers. Mm-hmm. Right. So there has been some situations where over the course of time some particular property has become more wet than it was back in here. So they have went through the process and delineated exactly how much land was impacted, and there has been some changes within the program.
Well, plus, if somebody has gone in and developed some of their property,
might
they may
some
lose some
up.
Of their TDRs.
Yeah,
correct.
Down a boundary line adjustment with
yeah.
your neighbor.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
The park's a different size than it was. Yeah, there's a lot of scenarios.
Mm-hmm. Correct. So there's one other purpose of the TDR bank, and that's to address a timing problem. And I'll explain what the timing problem is. So one purpose of the TDR bank is to hold that sort of backstop extra 1,000 TDRs. The other purpose is to address the timing problem. And a timing problem arises because the way the code was written, for the most part, what it assumes is that there is an existing identifiable receiving site lot that is available the moment that the sending site sells the TDRs, that they can be picked up from this lot and put on this lot. But as you've seen, as you've experienced the platting process and tent trails, that development occurs in phases and batches over time, and lots don't even exist until a final plat is approved. That's the whole point of doing a final plat, is to create a lot. So if you're talking about undeveloped area where there is no lot to put those TDRs on immediately, there has to be a mechanism to account for that timing problem between when you buy the TDRs and when you have a lot to put them on. And so the TDR bank can also operate as a trust. The TDR bank can act like a trustee. The city can be a trustee and hold those DRCs. They've been stripped off the sending site through a transaction. The developer goes and buys those TDRs. They're stripped off. The developer can't use them right away because they don't have a lot to put them on. So they can be held in trust through the accounting mechanism of Barb's TDR database and says, okay, these DRCs, these development rights, are going to be kept in trust until a final plat comes along and the developer says, okay, I need to extract. I've got 100 TDRs in trust. I want to pull 50 of those out and apply them to lots 120, 121, 122, 123, 124. And that goes on the final plat that then comes to you for a final approval to show, okay, they've used 50 TDRs for this plat. And through the chart that we looked at that show you can do that, you can adjust the numbers there and say, okay, they're meeting their threshold. You know, they're not exceeding the amount that they're allowed to build without TDRs. It's sort of an accounting check to make sure that they're living up to the TDR obligations. So that's what the trust feature of the TDR bank is designed to do, is to hold those until they have a final plat to plop those onto. Does that make sense? And it's that trust feature that brings us to the resolution that's in your council packet. And the reason the council needs to be involved in this process at this point is before a developer can use the trust feature, and it's not specific to Oak Point. Any developer that needs to use TDRs would have to go through this process. So it's just that we're at the point now where Oak Point is going to start needing TDRs and needing to use the trust program. So they're sort of the guinea pig in all of this and figuring out how we're going to use this trust, because we've never had to do it before. But we're at the point now where it's going to have to be used. So in order for a developer to use the trust account, the council has to take some actions. They have to approve a trust agreement with the developer. That's one of the exhibits to the resolution, the trust agreement. And that's basically just saying, okay, here's the terms on which the city is going to act as the trustee. Here's the process that the city's going to get paid for doing this extra work. Here's the process for how the city's going to ensure that the conservation easement gets recorded at the right time and that the Community Development Department gets notified of the transactions that are occurring so that we can keep track in the database of who's got what rights where. So this trust agreement lays out all the terms of how those mechanics work. So the council has to approve the entry of a trust agreement. The council also has to approve the ability of a sending site to have its rights stripped off without a lot to put them on right away. And so the way we've proposed this is that the council would go ahead, rather than picking and choosing what landowners get to benefit from this now, just going ahead and saying, okay, all the sending site areas in the city are eligible to participate in this trust process. Like I said, sort of instead of picking and choosing who you think ought to be able to participate, everyone gets to participate. All the properties through this resolution would be deemed appropriate to be used in this trust account fashion. And then the other point of the resolution is to establish a fee, which we don't currently have on our fee schedule, that compensates the city for doing these transfers in the database and adjusting the numbers and making sure we know who's got rights when. So really, those are the four things.
The whole program is a lot of work.
Doing the DRCs and all that.
This is not the only fee. We have other fees in the fee schedule. The one fee that we were missing was that actual transfer fee. Okay. We have a base application fee. We have a review fee. We have all the other fees, but we were missing that last step when you actually transfer.
How did you come up with the $24?
I calculated. I estimated the amount of time. I went through the steps that we would have to do and said, well, you know, probably take 15 minutes to do this one and, you know, 30 minutes to do this one.
So it's not just
going to... And then, you know, and then...
Mapped out to what the actual work is.
No, and then I multiplied the estimated time to do that transfer by the adopted rate of pay in our fee schedule for the planner to do it.
And is this a per TDRC or
per transaction? This is a per
transaction. So in other words, if they transferred 17 different DRCs
in one
transfer,
one DRC is a transfer.
Correct. Yes.
One DRC is a transfer.
Okay, so
but a DRC could have multiple TDRs, development rights, into it. So a DRC could have 100.
Oh, right.
Yeah. So
your 17 would be one.
Yeah. Would be one fee. Now that's different though from, because as
but
Barb
you
mentioned.
You split out your rights, so if you don't sell all your rights, you could have two fees for that.
If you do it in multiple stages.
Four of them now, okay, and then three of them later, there's two fees.
Right.
So it's not a per jar, it's a per transaction.
Correct.
But each of those transactions are for a single property owner with the TDRs, correct? Versus multiple homeowners getting together and combining their TDRs?
Well, that wouldn't be allowable. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. You would have to, you've got one certificate for, mm-hmm.
For that transaction, mm-hmm. for that property.
Right. Yeah.
All right.
And that doesn't matter if the properties own, the sending and receiving properties are owned by the same people or not, right?
Right.
It's a per transaction. Right.
Mm-hmm. Correct. And just to make sure everyone's on the same page, when the property owner comes in with their letter of notification that tells them how many TDRs we think they have, and they want to perfect that and turn it into an actual DRC, there's a separate fee for that,
yes.
and that is a per right, yes. per development right fee. So there's a base, like $50 fee just for the application, and then if you've got 10 TDRs, it's times 10, whatever the extra, whatever that increment is. I don't remember what the fee is. So up front, the actual verification and analysis that the city has to do to confirm the number of development rights, that is per right.
Right.
It's yeah. But the later transfer fee is the per transaction fee.
What other municipalities have done TDRs? Is Issaquah in them?
I don't know about Issaquah. I know that counties, the Holmes County.
King County does.
King County does. Because
I know years and years ago when all of this stuff was new, it was like we didn't want to be the first guinea pig.
Yeah.
Small municipality. Yeah. But now it's been used by other municipalities and the counties and system.
Yeah, there's not actually, there are not a lot of effective TDR programs because as nice as they sound in concept, the practicalities of implementing them can be very difficult. A lot of for that timing reason that I talked about before. Also, how many lenders do you know who are happy to have their collateral devalued or impaired by stripping development rights off? So unless you own the property outright, it's a harder thing to use. So
I know this is a proposed resolution, right? Do
correct.
We want to say the dollar figure in there, or do we want to put the function in there, right? So think about it as 6 years from now, when labor costs more, mm-hmm. we're still charging $324, do we go in and revise the resolution, or do we put it in the resolution that it says this many hours for whatever pay schedule?
It would be part of our fee schedule. Every time you update the fee schedule, you could change it. I mean, this number is just the number that would go in the current fee schedule. You could update the fee schedule anytime you want it.
It would be additional work to update it. We just do it when we do the fee schedule.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Line.
Yeah, this just
line.
This just
okay.
adds a new line.
We're going to make actual work for ourselves mm-hmm. 6 years from now, 10 years from now. 20 years from now, we're still charging $324. Maybe $300 resolution.
Yeah. Yeah. So on the resolution, those were the kind of the four things that the resolution does. I wanted to spend a little time talking about the attachments to the resolution, which is the trust agreement and particularly the conservation easement, because I think the conservation easement is probably the item that the council would be most interested in from a policy angle. The trust agreement is largely a kind of a ministerial exercise. It can certainly answer questions you may have about it, but it essentially just blesses the use of the TDR bank to hold these DRCs and puts forth the terms of how they're going to be processed within the city and how it's going to get paid for. It's not that interesting. The more, from a policy perspective, the more interesting thing I would think for you is the conservation easement, which is...
That's on page 17.
There you go, 17 of 31.
On your resolution, if you want to get it out.
I put the little red page numbers on there, hoping that would make it easier to spot.
Yeah. Oh, I do have a comment here, too.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. You say the grantee is the city of Savannah.
Oh, sorry. That's, yeah, we'll fix that.
It is.
It is. They're getting us all our CDRs. Well, that just shows that this this document was modified from one that we had used before. Good catch, Janie.
I think it's shift F4 for final.
Yeah.
sorry
about that. So this is a significantly modified version, though, from the City of Sammamish one, because the one in Sammamish wasn't designed for a TDR program like this. It was designed for something else. But a lot of the same concepts are built into it. And by concepts, I mean the restrictions that are being placed on the uses of the property where the rights are being stripped off. And the key things are probably that you would want to look at are in section 4 and 5. So page 19 is the start of section 4. And that's the grantor's reserved rights. So the seller of their TDRs is the grantor. So this tells the property owner what they can still do with their property once the development rights have been sold. And then by contrast, section 5, which starts on page 21, that's your list of prohibited uses and activities. Those are things you can no longer do once you've sold your property or sold your development rights. And those restrictions are designed to preserve what this agreement refers to as the conservation values. So all those things that makes the property special, all the things that the city was hoping to protect and preserve, these restrictions are designed to make sure that those things are perpetually guaranteed. So you can no longer subdivide the conserved property. You can't build most types of structures except certain things like stormwater management. You can do things like that. You have to account for, you know, anything that causes erosion, water pollution, waste disposal, all these types of things that really restrict what can and can't be done on the property. I don't want to walk through each of those things now because there's a lot, but if you have any questions about that. Yeah.
What if you don't cause erosion or water pollution to happen, mm-hmm. but God does, or,
sure.
you know, a natural disaster or whatever, if your property then becomes not appropriate anymore, but you already are in this process. Mm-hmm. Is that like too bad, so bad, or what happens then?
Yeah, so you're not penalized for acts of God, acts of nature, things like that. You know, this prohibits you making any use or activity within the conservation zone. But if that does happen, you know, a storm hits and knocks down, blows down all your trees, yeah, sorry, the conservation zone is still applicable. And hopefully maybe one day they'll grow back because they're perpetually preserved.
But would the owner be responsible for replacing or repairing the property in back into the condition under which they sold their life?
No, it doesn't. This doesn't force any kind of, you know, restoration. You're not having to restore things. This is a conservation, not a restoration requirement. Good question, though. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Good thing for people to think about. Mm-hmm. And in fact, some of the restoration activities that you might want to do might, you know, there's limitations on what you can actually do.
Right.
You know,
you can't do planting or
agricultural activities. You can't recreate on it. There will be no recreation.
Well, there can be some recreation. Yes, you can have passive recreation. So that's in section 4.1.1. Passive recreational activities such as walking, picnicking, traversing, observing wildlife, provided that the activities don't or aren't conducted in a manner or intensity that adversely affects the conservation value. So you can't, you know.
Maybe have a.
Ride your 4x4s through the wetlands.
Right,
you know,
exactly.
You can't do that. But.
Well, that's coming under motor vehicles, so you can't drive motor vehicles.
Correct, yeah, right.
Hmm.
you can. Councilmember Stout, this kind of goes to your question a little bit. Section 4.1.5 is the maintenance. So there are certain types of maintenance activities that you can do to protect and preserve your property for the conservation values. So you can plant or replant native species. You can do weeding.
You can weed it.
Yes. And of course, this doesn't replace the city's sensitive area ordinance. So, you know, all the regulations that would normally apply under Chapter 1910, those don't go away. This is sort of a supplemental. This is kind of creating new protected areas, not just conserving the ones that are already protected under the. Well, it's an agreement that the property owner agrees to undertake if they're going to strip off their rights, and it gets recorded. Yeah, it's a binding contract that's recorded.
On page 26, it talks about
Right.
I assume that this is probably pretty much boilerplate-type language.
Yeah.
Of course, the people that they would be properly compensated.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess what it talks about, if it's the court makes a decision, is that how that works?
So this, if it's, you know, you can't condemn, I mean, a court has to determine that the property meets the requirements for a condemnation, and the court may also have to determine the amount of compensation if the parties can't agree. So there would be a, you know, to actually get to a completed condemnation, there would have to be a court determination of that process. Barb, did I cover it, you think?
Yeah.
Oh, just kind of one little extra concept or nuance of the conservation easement. So if in the event a party, let's say, we'll go back to my previous example, where a party just wants to sell part of their TDRs, not want to sell all of them. So if they, you know, let's say they have 50 TDRs and they want to sell 25. That 25 out of 50, under the conservation easement, that creates a conservation percentage, so 50% in that case. The conservation easement would have to be applied, drawn, to affect and preserve 50% of that property. So they can't, the property owner can't, you know, sell 80% of their TDRs and only put the conservation easement on 10% of their property. It has to match up with the concept of, okay, you're releasing 50% of your development rights. We want 50% of it conserved in a contiguous open space, because that's the whole point of this, is to conserve open space.
Is there actually a document that would show that property and then, you know, drawn out, here's the 80%, and you've got this, and here's the rest of it? Is that all part of the recording of King County?
Yeah, so the concept is that at the time that they do the transaction, they would have to determine through a survey or some sort of, you know, legally binding description of where that conservation zone is on the property.
Well, and the challenge for the department is being able to quickly look at that. Because it's going to be in a legal description. If, you know, we would hope there's a map attached. But if there isn't, you know, we probably want to talk about it a later time when we really are going to get in deep with this, is to think about our GIS program and be able to have that in our mapping database.
Mm-hmm.
because otherwise it's going to take staff too long to figure it out.
Maybe outsource some.
30 paces from the big tree to the little tree by the big rock there.
We'll feel a little bit more technical.
Let's hope a surveyor would do a little better than that.
By the rotten fence post.
Like when I bought my first house back in New York, right, which was built in the 1790s, right? The title history, right, looking through that stuff, has stuff like that in it.
Well, and there's nothing to keep us as the city or the city council from amending these resolutions in the future as we go through this process. This is not something that is a vesting issue, is it?
Yes and no. Probably a conversation for another day, but the TDR code can be amended in ways that doesn't impose extra burdens on any developer who's vested to the TDR code.
Right. So the developer is vested to certain things in the development agreement.
But there are parts of the development code that really are only affecting the city, and those things can be changed anytime we want to change them. And if we find that this particular trust agreement, if the council were to authorize the mayor to execute this trust agreement, and we find that there's things about it that aren't working, then we know for the next time, okay, we need to change this and that. You know, that you can always do
so
that.
So is it every time someone wants us, the developer comes to us and says, hey, I want to put these in trust, you need to do one of these?
You would need a new agreement for that particular beneficiary. That trustor needs a new agreement.
And how many are there on that list, approximately?
On the board sending?
Yeah.
Are we doing a new resolution?
380. You don't. Yeah. So you wouldn't be doing a resolution for 380 sending sites. You'd only need a resolution with a trust agreement for a receiving site. Because that's the receiving site. Exactly.
Right.
Right. But this is what I'm saying is, if another developer comes in and says they want to develop someplace else,
yes,
they want to do a trust, we need another resolution.
Correct. Yes.
Correct. I was thinking trying to streamline the process. Mm-hmm. We made the resolution so that there were certain gates for any trust that put up, then we wouldn't need a new resolution every time, right? We would just need to make sure they jump through the right hoops.
Well, you're entering into a new contract.
It's a new contract,
yeah,
so
yeah.
You'd have to do it every time. But the way these documents have been drawn up, they're not customized for Oak Point. These are applicable to any developer.
Yeah.
So the documentation would actually be very similar. It would just be changing the names on the agreement,
right,
and changing the names of the resolution, and you know, sort of that.
Because I realize we'd have to have a separate trust agreement, right?
Right.
But you could make the process of those trust agreements being created and finalized more commodity than the process in place in the resolution instead of the actual procedure.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And the process is largely in the code. It's the question of developing the documents that implement the process. And I think these documents at least are intended to be multi-purpose. So hopefully the next time it comes up, if it does come up again, we won't have to have a work session about it.
So. And one of the underlying facts is, and why we're here tonight, is because we're obligated, we, you the council, us as the leaders of the staff, to make this program work. It's the staff's belief that through this trust mechanism is a tool we need to make the program work. It is a very time-consuming, very labor-intensive process, just currently as it is. But we believe this is a tool that would allow the program to actually get going and kind of fulfill some of those things that we'd always talked about. When, you know, in like code, as you all are learning, we think we have it right, and you find out 4 years later you don't have it right. Well, here we thought we had it right. We're now looking 15 years later, and there's some tweaks that need to be done with it.
Are there other cities that have trusts like this, or are we kind of the first one to try a trust approach?
I don't know the answer to that. They're not actually, the trust part of this code isn't the new part.
No.
It's already here. We were just actually figuring out what the mechanics
right
were to use the trust. So the trust is not in place.
Right. It's the mechanics to make it work.
Section 065 of that TDR code is the trust already created. It's just we didn't have the step-by-step. Correct.
Right.
Yeah.
I have something in off the track question. Is there a way to enforce the use of the property once the TDRs have been approved? We have like major code enforcers.
Oh.
I mean, not smoothing out. If it requires a building permit and the person that wants to do the development is realizes that they should get a building permit, then that's how we know. If something does not require a building permit, or they just want to build something without getting an appropriate permit, then that's where your code that's where your code person would have to go out and. But it's not that like the city has resources even today.
No, this situation.
It exists today without this extra layer that, people, for example, the shoreline, they may be doing stuff in the shoreline setback that isn't allowed under our shoreline program, but we don't have people out patrolling because, as you can imagine, we don't have the resources for that.
Yeah.
So. Usually, the way that we know about that this activity is with somebody reports it.
And Councilor, a second part, I think, of your question is, one is the staffing. Do we have the staffing to monitor? The first part, though, is what are the mechanisms for enforcing? And the conservation easement, Section 7, lays out a detailed process for giving notice of violation and what happens if that violation isn't cured, and the authority of the city to enforce the restrictions that were intended when the conservation easement was recorded. And so that kind of lays out a very robust authority from the city to be able to enforce, assuming there are resources available to actually do it.
Yeah, I mean, currently, most of the staff knows where things should or should not be done, understands wetlands, understands the boundaries, where the utility crews are or my guys or Barb's people or whatever. If we find that we believe someone has impacted the wetlands or has done something, they come back in and the senior management gets together, has a discussion, and then generally two people go out and investigate that situation. Or a neighbor calls and says, yeah, I just saw him bury a car in the backyard. I just made that up, but and we'd probably go out there, you know, or those kind of things.
So another question. How does the city determine the price of the city-owned TDRs?
It's a fair market value.
Fair market value.
So it could be done, it could be done through an appraisal. It can be done through comparing to other transactions that have been completed. Exactly.
So, but it would be a comp to the receiving party? Because if all we have is a bank of 1,000 TDRs, it's really not property per se.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so.
I mean, fair market value of what?
Yeah, because you don't have a base property to take.
Yeah, it's not like, you know, my property is worth X amount of dollars, and if I'm going to have, you know, a TDR, then it's worth this much. Mm-hmm. But if this is just a bank with some numbers in it,
you would have an appraiser determine the fair market value by looking at transactions involving other properties where conservation easements have been either removed or added, and what the difference in market value of that property was before and after the conservation easement. And so, you know, it's obviously not probably a challenge for an appraiser to find comparable transactions, but I know it's done. And in fact, if you remember a couple of years ago when the Bonneville Power Administration acquired some land from the city that was subject to a conservation easement, the value of that easement had to be valued. And an appraiser who specializes in conservation lands, forests, and other kind of things was able to come up with
a... There was physical land in that transaction.
Well, there's still physical land here. It's a piece of property with development rights and that same piece of property
without
buildings.
Well, not if it's the city.
Oh, but if it's the city.
Imagine correct, our 1,000 TDRs as bridge financing, right?
Okay.
It's that gap financing piece, right? So we'll do a couple. Remember, even in the city's ordinance here, it says that once we determine what our price is that we're the city, you authorize us and we have that price and we're going to go out and sell it. We then still have to go out and reach out to all the people on the TDR list and tell them the city is getting ready to sell, well, let's say 100, easy math, 100 at $50,000 a TDR. Wouldn't that be awesome? But anyways.
Dream on.
So, yeah. Then we would give anybody else, that we'll say, we're going to sell this many on this day. You have the opportunity to still sell your TDRs at that price, too.
Okay.
So, again, it lets the people back into the market again one last time. Like, okay, well, yeah, I will. Right.
So, for the TDRs out of the bank, I'm assuming that the assessor would look at the current land type and then do that comparison of before and after. Or what if this land was, you know, more zoned differently, right? Or
yeah, I mean, I think I'm not an appraiser. I don't really know how they would go about doing it. But there would be some mechanism for assigning kind of in the abstract. You know, maybe the range of TDRs of all different types of property is anywhere from 5 to 10,000, and they pick the middle, or, you know, who knows what they would really do. But
yeah, kind of the same thing that they did with Thompson, age and all that kind of stuff. So we can't set the price, fund the new fire trucks.
Well, you can set the price, but it has to be based on fair market value.
Not fair market.
Anything else? Any other? So I know it's a lot to process and bring in all at once, which is why we wanted to have a work session to talk about it before you actually had to make any kind of decisions. Obviously, send me or the mayor or Andy or Barb any questions that you have or things that you'd like to us to think about and change or incorporate.
We've had quite a few meetings, and we have all of the documents here have all been coordinated through the attorneys, through Oak Point, and through our city. So we've already had 3 or 4 meetings about this and before we presented it to you. So.
Well, thank you, because I
watched
all of this stuff. You asked it every single question that I had before I asked it.
Very good. That's what I try to do. Anticipate.
I was looking through all the stuff last night on my iPad, and I was like, this is like an abstract thing.
Yeah, it's not intuitive. In terms of...
What are the next steps?
No, okay, so the next steps would be that this resolution would come back to council, and the council could vote to approve the resolution, which would be to authorize the mayor to sign the trust agreement and the other items, you know, approve the fee and so forth. If at the, you know, in between now and the next council meeting, if you have questions you'd like that you didn't occur to you today, we can figure that out. If the council talks about it at the next council meeting and is ready to act, then you could act. If you feel like it needs more time to bake, we could let it bake a little longer, you know. However, you know, it's your call.
It won't be the next
council. It won't be next council, right?
The second one?
Yeah. Oh, right, because we're already past the packet.
Yeah, we're
correct.
Past.
Sorry, yeah. I forgot this is Thursday, not Tuesday. But, yeah. Okay. So, yeah, that'd be even more time to let it bake before the next meeting.
I'm
moving to
adjourn this meeting. Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Meeting adjourned.
Basically, that's really how it works.